Was the card the Ace of Spades?
No, but I knew you were going to ask that.
And then I remember stuff piling on me, and then I realized I couldn't breathe any longer. I couldn't breathe. And there was somebody laying on my shoulder. And all I could see was blonde hair.
We never processed it. We held it. We bottled it up. We never really, I mean, you know, we could have all fucking died, right? I mean, we could have easily all died. But Cliff died.
And Bobby and I have never, just so you know, a disclaimer, Bobby and I have never had this discussion before.
I don't think I've had it with anybody.
No.
Hey guys, this is Joel. You're watching my podcast, Party Like a Rock Star. Today's episode is a little bit different than a lot of the other interviews I did. A lot of the other interviews I was pushing on humor. My book is filled with a lot of humor. This episode deals with some, for lack of a better word, heavy stuff. Both of these guys, Aidan Mullen and Bobby Schneider, worked for Metallica way back in the day. Both of them were on the bus when Cliff Burton died. It's a terrible day in music, and it was a difficult interview, to be honest. I think it was hard for all of us, but I think it was healthy for these guys. And that, of course, means a lot to me. I care about my roadies. I do. And so what should happen here is you guys should be able to listen to some awesome, interesting content for you as fans. But the goal of all of us was that people remember Cliff Burton for who he was, a person who was instrumental in one of the best bands in history. And these guys went through some hard things for them to go through. So keep it in mind. If you haven't watched any of my podcasts and you don't know who I am, I'm an ex-roadie too. I used to work for bands like Guns N' Roses, Stone Temple Pilots, Poison, and the Cranberries. I wrote a book called Memoir of a Roadie, and it was the number one new release on Amazon and Bios. It's done 3 million copies on Kindle, and I've been riding an amazing roller coaster of fun. In doing that, I started interviewing other roadies. I have interviewed Aidan. You can check out his interview here if you want, the first time he came on, and learn more about him if you want. And I've also brought on Bobby Schneider. You can check that one out, again, right here, if you want to check out Bobby's episode when he came on the first time. Anyway, without further delay, let's begin. So to get things going, how did each of you guys get involved with Metallica? So Bobby came first, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
Okay. And you were friends with John, or how did you get into it?
Well, Howard Ungerleiter was the tour manager, and I'd worked with Howard on Rush.
Oh, cool.
And they came through Boston. It's a good story, actually. They came through Boston where I was the stage manager at a great club called the Channel Club. And I don't know that I'd ever heard of them, really, because I, you know, didn't, that wasn't really my genre music. I mean, so the bill was Metallica, Armored Saint, and Wasp. Certainly not in that order, especially not according to Wasp. And anyway, my buddy Bob Yurko was driving, who I worked with for years in different things, was out driving a truck for them. And so anyway, we did the show, and they left. And I guess, I remember what, something happened with the drum roadie. I guess they left them behind at one show. It's maybe some Canada immigration, but basically the guy also destroyed a hotel room. So Howard knew me and Bob knew me. And so I guess when this went down, they said, well, you know, we just saw Bobby. So come in, you know, you should call him. He just finished working for Tony Thompson. I used to be, it was drummer. It's one of the things I did to start. Anyway, so I went out, I flew to Detroit, Ann Arbor, Royal Oak Theater, remember it exactly. And I became Lars's drum roadie. And I was the drum roadie. And then I just, you know, they didn't really have anyone running things crew-wise. And you guys, well, Joel's never worked with me, but Aidan knows. I mean, I was large and in charge quickly. And then Howard had to leave to go back to Rush. So we did that tour. And then Howard had to leave to go back to Rush. And he said, well, should just have Bobby do it. He's pretty much running everything anyway. So Howard and I sat in... and I wish I'd say this.
Sorry, were you drum teching for Rush too?
No, I was a lighting guy for Rush.
Oh, you're a lighting guy? I didn't know that. Okay.
And yeah, anyway, so Howard said he trained me, and I hadn't been really a tour manager. I mean, I've worked for local bands where I was the only guy or I was some kind of manager. But anyway, so Howard trained me how to settle and a bunch of other things in an ill-fated afternoon at the Franklin Plaza in L.A.
Me.
Well, that was the place. We should talk about that if we want to laugh a little bit. But anyway, and that was it. And then six years, I was your tour manager.
That's neat. And so did you, well, you didn't hire Aiden. Aiden would have come through the PM, yeah, or through the band, or?
There was no PM. I mean, for most of the time I was there, I mean, and that was probably my, I don't know, I mean, just reflecting, I mean, that was probably part of my, I'd say my downfall there, because I did everything for the longest time. I think even when Aiden was out, yeah. I don't remember where we got Aiden from. So, so I'll turn it over to Aiden for a minute, because otherwise, you know, you'll just keep hearing me talk.
Well, yes. So you actually called me at my parents' house in Sebastopol, California.
Rest, I had, he was a good man. Rest in peace.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, I got a call from Bobby one day out of the blue. I had moved back in with my folks at the particular time and, you know, just kind of rethinking things. They were in Sebastopol up in Sonoma County, beautiful place to live.
Yeah.
And I was working for the band Y&T at the time.
That's right. Maybe Nigel gave me your number.
I would imagine. And, you know what I think it was? I think it was Adam Day, because I think he called him first. And so I get a call one day from this guy, Bobby Snyder, asking if I would be interested in working for the band Metallica. And as he said, same with me, way out of my wheelhouse. I, you know, I grew up listening to Peter Frampton and Journey and, you know, all the slickly polished bands.
Montrose, and right? Wasn't that your jam?
Montrose was my first concert. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, ironically enough, my first gig with Y&T was a day on the green in Oakland, California. They used to have these amazing festival shows and they would stack them, you know, all summer long, Saturday and Sunday, about every other Saturday and Sunday throughout the summer. And you'd see just amazing combinations of bands. So my first gig with Y&T was Day on the Green in Oakland. And on that bill, along with us, were the Scorpions were the headliner. Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force was on that. And this band that I knew nothing about from the East Bay called Metallica. And I distinctly remember there was a big ramp coming down from the parking lot that would come down to where they had the stage built in center field in the Oakland A's baseball stadium. And I think the Raiders played football there for a while. So I'm standing at the top of the ramp in the afternoon, and I hear what I can only describe as a cacophony. And I'm not referring to the band cacophony necessarily, but I hear this sound and I'm like, what the fuck is that, you know? So I go down the ramp and I walk out onto the stage and I see these guys whipping their hair around and screaming in anger and the crowd just gobbling it up. And I thought, you know, who are these guys? And it turned out to be, of course, it was Metallica.
Yeah.
And that was my only exposure to Metallica until Bobby called me and asked me if I would consider coming to work for James. So the next day, I remember distinctly, he called again and put James on the phone. We had a chat, great conversation. And we were the same age at that point. What were we, Bobby, 23, 22, 24, something like that?
Yeah, that's about right.
you know, right in that, in a ballpark. So we were all,
you know, those guys are about 4 years younger than me. So,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm 60 now. So
they'll, you know, all be hitting 60 this year, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. 86. It was 1986, summer 1986.
So you were after Andy Batty then, right?
I was after, I took, yeah. Cause Andy just, he'd left at that point. That was why you were looking for somebody. So, I, you know, we had a great conversation. I liked what I was hearing. I liked the money that was being offered. I won't actually tell you what it was because it was pretty crap by today's standards. But back then, it was certainly more than I had ever made before. And I would be on a plane days later to, I want to say, Knoxville, if I'm not mistaken. And it might have even been Nashville and then a ride to Knoxville on a show day. So they were supporting Ozzy Osbourne at the time. Mm-hmm. And they were making a big noise, you know, at that point. This was towards the end of the Ozzy tour now.
Old Ozzy shirts often.
Yes. 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 And so I agreed to do it. And the day before I arrived in Nashville, Knoxville, wherever it was, James fell and broke his arm skateboarding in a swimming pool.
That was in Indianapolis, Evansville.
Evansville, Indiana. So that was right before you guys got to Tennessee. And by the time I arrived, John Marshall had been moved over to play James's parts.
Right. Sort of off stage.
Yes, sort of off stage. Almost off stage at that point, but that kind of changed over time. And all of a sudden, I was working for this guy, Kirk Hammett, I knew nothing about. It all kind of fell into place pretty easily. But one of the things that I do remember was really having a hard time understanding my job and our jobs at that point, and it's become more so now than ever before, is that you need to know the music that's being played. You need to be able to know where you are in a song. You need to be able to push a button. You need to be able to move a mic stand. You need to be able to do this, that, and the other. I couldn't figure that stuff out, man. I had no idea what I was hearing. Every song sounded the same. And, you know, and
form yet though, were you?
You know, I'm my dad now. What can I say? But, you know, it was a confusing, wonderful, stressful, you know, all of those things. But I would have to, Brian Hendry was the monitor engineer at that point, wasn't he?
Well, Brian Hendry was the monitor engineer for Ozzy.
Oh, okay. So it was Brian that would have to tap me on the shoulder and tell me, get ready to bring that microphone out for Kirk.
I guess he must have done monitors at that point. I don't know. I'd have to think back. I mean,
I remember it was him, and I remember him tapping me on, because I'd stand there, I'd have a microphone stand in my hand because Kirk would do the die, you know? Right. And again, I don't know what song it is, you know? So he would tap me on the shoulder and say, get ready to go. And then he'd tap me on the shoulder and say, go put it out there. And then I'd get off the stage, and then he'd tap me on the shoulder and say, go get it.
So you were supposed to text for James.
Yep.
You didn't because he couldn't play.
Right.
And then you became the tech for Kirk.
Yep.
Got it.
So I worked
the rest of the back line.
So there was a guy that I didn't see for probably the first four shows. I kept hearing about him. And he was Cliff's bass tech. His name was Eddie Kircher.
Okay.
But I never saw him because he was driving the truck. So we would get done with the show and we would load out and then he'd leave. So I had no idea who the guy was until actually later on, shortly thereafter, we started a tour in Europe, in the UK. And all of a sudden I was designated as Eddie's roommate in the hotels. we could spend an entire show just talking about that. And then Fleming Larson.
I have honestly forgotten all of this. I guess I had my own shit to do.
Well, I've forgotten more than I remember.
Bobby,
where was I when I was?
No, who did you share a room with?
I didn't share them.
Mm-mm.
Oh, there you go.
No, and Bobby, if you'll indulge me, I can tell a clean version of a story. My first day with Metallica was arriving in, again, I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and actually look at a schedule. So I want to say it was Knoxville.
We missed one show. I'm going to look it up now, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious which one it was. It might have been Nashville. It might have been the Municipal Auditorium in Nashville.
I don't know, but you know what I don't remember is why Batty would have left so quickly, and why we would have had to replace somebody in the middle of
why who?
Why Andy Batty or whoever was doing?
From what I recall, I think he just got fed up and walked away one day, didn't he?
Well, I certainly don't remember that.
Yeah, and I don't know because I didn't know him at the time. I didn't meet Andy till
Joe. We need a number two.
Yeah, we'll have to. Well, and the other baddie actually said to say hi to you guys, Kevin Walsh. So
yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We had some good times with him. Metal Church.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I fly out from California, not knowing anything about this band and not really, you know, understanding all of the ramifications involved of, you know, James has been injured and Kirk and this, that, and the other, and it's all new. So I think it might've made things a little bit easier for me that things were in such turmoil at that point, because I wasn't the only one that was sweating things.
Okay.
You know, and so I get to where we are. I'm driven to a hotel and I'm told that the first thing I need to do when I get to the hotel is I need to knock on Bobby Snyder's door in the hotel room. So I go to the front desk. I say who I am. I say, yep, he's in such and such a room. So I get in the glass elevator. It's one of those like Embassy Suite style with all the rooms kind of facing down into the lobby area.
We're in Europe, right? We're in Europe now.
No. This was my Tennessee? First show. So this was in Tennessee.
Okay.
Knoxville. It was Knoxville.
Well, I am going to find out what happened between, it was Nashville. The show after Evansville was Nashville. That's where he broke his arm.
Right.
I mean, I wonder, let's see, who would have been taking care of James? Would Batty have been doing that? I don't
know. Yeah. I don't know. You and I haven't ever discussed this before, who was there before me.
This is intriguing to me that in the middle of that run that someone left. John Marshall definitely was Kirk's guy forever.
Yep. Fleming was there.
Started playing.
Yep.
So, yeah, we needed someone to take care of Kirk.
Right.
And James, I don't know. You know, I mean,
James was singing with a cast.
Batty used to take care of James and Cliff.
Right. Yeah.
And then Eddie Kircher came in and he was Cliff's roadie.
Yep.
But by the time he was Cliff's roadie, the gear, I remember, I mean, I made the deal. The gear was going in Ozzy's truck. So I don't remember driving a truck at that point. Maybe,
you know, that. Yeah, I'd have to say no, only because this was right before my birthday. My birthday is August 1st.
Okay.
So I celebrated my birthday out with those guys. And the night of my birthday, instead of being able to hang out and have a couple of cocktails as we normally would, I was tasked with driving that Ryder truck that night and had to drive overnight. So there was definitely a backline Ryder truck involved in the process at that point.
Yeah.
For sure. And I was
like, gloss over.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking, man, these guys really like to have a good time. I can't wait to celebrate my birthday on the road with these guys. And there I am in a Ryder truck, you know.
With Kircher or on your own?
On my own.
So how many gigs did you do in the U.S. before you guys went to Europe?
Well, Bobby, that was towards the end of the Aussie tour. So I would imagine no more than maybe a 2 weeks worth at that point.
A short run.
Yeah. They were all but finished. They'd been doing the entire summer with Ozzy.
Okay.
At that point. So
and then you guys go to Europe, and is James's arm better at that point?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So James was in the cast. John was playing his parts, setting up and tearing down his gear. Eddie was looking after.
John was going to quit.
John was going to. Yes.
John had to be his own tech.
Yes. Yes. He wasn't happy about that.
And right. And it was you and Kircher.
Yep. And Fleming,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Fleming, rest in peace.
God bless him. Yeah. Yeah. One of the nicest guys in show business. Jag.
Great.
So we went home.
Come in after all that, after you left, I guess. Danny Murphy ended up taking care of Kirk.
Danny Murphy. No. Danny Murphy came in while I was still there. So what we did at that point was we came home, and then I was all excited because, you know, I'd done clubs and gigs here and there in America, but you know, now all of a sudden we're flying to the UK to start a European tour, my first European tour.
Okay.
You know, I got some experience flying over there. My
did
folks.
Did you get out of the border to Scotland?
Yeah, I can't remember.
So Joel, back in the day, anybody knew? Nothing ever happened to me, because I probably told someone to fuck themselves. But so if you were gullible enough and knew enough, going into Scotland, of course, there's no border, but the bus driver would stop and you tell the guy, well, you have to go, you have to take your passport, you have to go clear.
That wasn't me. No.
And we'd actually make people get off the bus in the dark. I mean, it was just on the side of the road. Oh, it's up the road there a little bit.
No, wasn't me. At that point, my parents lived in Ireland for the longest time. So I, you know, I spent a good portion of my life going back and forth. Probably tried. I probably said, go fuck yourself. Yeah. So the next step in the process is flying to the UK, and I live in the Bay Area. The band lives in the Bay Area. So we all get on this Pan Am 747 going from San Francisco to London. And because I'm the new guy, Cliff is the only smoker in the band, and they need somebody to ride back with him in smoking section on the aircraft.
I smoked. Kircher smoked.
Yeah, but I was the new guy, so that was me back there. And ironically enough, I had never spoken to Cliff before that time. And by the time we got off that plane, I had a great deal of respect for the guy. We had a great time just talking about stuff. And sorry I didn't.
On the same area, basically, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I just,
what
you know.
What did you guys talk about?
Just life, you know? Growing up, our families, music. What do you know, what did two guys talk about? You know, it was, you know, just getting to know each other, basically.
Did
and
you smoke cigarettes too?
Oh no, I'm allergic to half the stuff in a cigarette. Oh. So it was a pretty rough 8-9 hour flight.
Did you tell me you were allergic and I made you sit back there anyway?
What's that?
Did you tell me you were allergic and I made you sit back there anyway?
I might not have told you.
You told me you were allergic.
I might not have told you.
No, probably not.
You know?
See, that's the old roadie creed, isn't it? Just suck it up.
Suck it up.
Do that. You
know, it's an experience that I'll never forget.
If I did that now, even though there's no smoking on any plane, and you could sue me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, listen. Yeah. Any whole list of things.
Off the plane, and you guys are buds now, sort of. At least you know the guy a bit.
Well, what I do want to do is take a quick step back to the hotel in Nashville, Knoxville. I go and I knock on this hotel room door to meet Bobby Schneider for the first time. The guy answers the door in the all together with all the lights off, and so my first meeting with Bobby was face to face. And he didn't have a stitch of clothing on. So that.
That's a thought many people want to carry, but.
Right. Okay. And so that happens. And then I end up being roommates with Eddie Kircher on the road. So I've got a lot of trauma in my background, you know.
That's what you talked about with Cliff. You ever seen a grown man naked?
Yeah. He was talking about Eddie Kircher.
Yeah, that too. So yeah, so you know, fast forward, England, we're going to rehearse in Birmingham, where we Big Mick and Drain, our LD, are both from
that's who the
at that point. Yeah, so we rehearsed for a time, I don't remember how long, maybe 10 days 12 days.
Right,
we have a great time rehearsing, getting to know each other. And then I think, now I want to say, Bobby, that James did 2 or 3 shows in the UK in the cast still. I've got some photos, and I know that he did it in Dublin. We were at the SFX in Dublin. So I've got a picture of myself tuning Kirk's guitar with Kirk standing next to me at the SFX, surrounded by my cousins that all came down to the show that day.
Oh, that's cool.
And
so during those rehearsal days, I mean, were you guys partying your asses off? I mean, you're all in your early 20s, everybody. Or were you guys pretty...
We were good, professionals.
Focused, professional.
I'd say yes to all of that. You know, there were
considered professional those days is a lot different than what's considered professional now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'd go along with that. All right. We had a good time, and you know, by that time I was starting to feel a little bit more comfortable in the position and surrounded, you know, in the genre, because again, man, my musical upbringing did not include anything remotely close. But
so your dad was in an Irish band though, right?
My dad was a singer. He was a crooner in Ireland back in the late 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Appreciate you remembering that. Yeah. Yeah. He was. Yeah. But, you know, old standards and Bing Crosby records and Nat King Cole records didn't go far enough to get me ready for what I had in store, you know.
But his dad was cool.
Yeah. My dad was cool. Yeah. Absolutely. He was. And then, you know, from there, we toured the UK. And then, you know, ironically, we had a double decker bus at that point in the UK.
That's right.
And we did London, Dublin. I want to say we did the Barrowlands in Glasgow, if I'm not mistaken. We did.
I'm looking at the dates.
Edinburgh.
That was with production.
Yeah.
So yeah, we did all the UK dates, and we ended in. We did play the Mayfair Ballroom in Newcastle. That was.
Yes.
Rides of a place.
Yes, we did.
And we finished in London.
Yep. Yep. I think we also did.
Your crew is small still. You guys are kind of a skeleton crew.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you had, you know, had a, I think it was a monitor, you know, of course, Big Mick. I don't know if Paul Owen had started mixing monitors at that point, or there was another guy we used to call Big Shirt. There was Drain, was the LD. Aiden, of course, John Marshall. Eddie Kircher and me,
and Fleming. Am I mistaken in thinking that that may have been when Danny Murphy came on board, or no?
Danny Murphy came on board before we started with Monsters of Rock.
Okay, all right.
So you guys are all touring in the same bus, and all the gear is in Ozzy's trucks.
Well, no, in Europe we had production.
We were headlining. At that point, it was their first.
And there was no production manager, so I was still doing everything. And we were all on one bus, and I probably had one truck.
Okay. Sounds right.
That sounds all right. Right. I'm maybe two. So we're cruising through. We get through England, and then we move on to Scotland, and then we move on to.
Well, then we go to Europe. Look, I got the dates in front of me.
Okay. How long was the whole run?
The first date in Europe was in Sweden. And we did 3 shows. We ended in the accident, which we'll probably get to. And I think that's part of the reason we're talking about remembering Cliff today, was after Stockholm.
Right. So how many shows were there before Stockholm?
In Europe?
In Europe, yeah.
Three.
Oh, like not a lot.
Besides the UK.
We've done you guys had a different bus in the UK?
Well, I don't remember what happened, why we switched buses or what we had.
I don't remember why. I remember us doing it. I remember us going to a lowrider.
I mean, I don't know if I can even say the name of the company. I don't think they're around anymore. Buses in those days, there were not many purpose-built buses, almost none.
Right.
Buses in the UK were tour buses, were basically tour buses for, you know, sit-up. So what they did is they'd convert them quickly, and they put up bunks in the back. And then, you know, the rest of the bus were just seats, like regular seats in a coach.
Okay.
I don't know why we got a new bus in England or what exactly happened. But anyway, we ended up on a bus and they had built this pretty quickly, I think. Like, I'm wondering, I don't know. I can't imagine we did all of England without buses.
No, we had the double-decker bus throughout England. We did all of England, Scotland, Ireland, and I don't think we went to Wales, but we had the double-decker bus throughout, and then we changed when we went over to Scandinavia.
Well, they never – so when we got the bus in London, it was a quick job, we'll say, of putting the bus together.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was fairly common that they would just put the bunks in, and it would be like the bunk in a window.
Right.
Okay. Just a regular coach window.
Yeah.
Curtains. So.
So when you got the new bus, it was with a new driver, new company. Maybe it's because you guys went to a different country. You got a different bus.
Don't remember. But
yeah, you know. I don't either.
But anyway, we had this new bus. The bus seemed fine. It was a legitimate company. And it was nothing like anybody said, whoa, this is dangerous. Nothing like that.
No.
Driver was actually fine. We did, you know, we started the days with them. It wasn't, there was, you know, I mean, I'll say this, there was definitely nothing wrong going into this. So okay. There was nothing suspicious. There was no one uncomfortable or anything like that.
No, nothing like that.
And so we were, you know, we were on this European tour. I mean, we were heading to Copenhagen. Which is Lars, this was a big deal for Lars and, sure. You know, and the band, because it's, you know, it's where they recorded two of the records. So, I mean, it was, so we're all on the bus at night. And at one point, there was a discussion between, well, of course, the band would choose their bunks first. And then probably I would get next choice. And there was a discussion between a bunk that both Cliff and Kirk wanted. And of course, when they wanted it, I was out of the draw. So I just backed out. And they drew a card at the beginning of that run, and Cliff got that bunk.
Yeah.
Was the card the Ace of Spades?
No, but I knew you were going to ask that.
Okay.
Nothing's that fucking coincidental.
Yeah. Do you know the card or
doesn't? I mean, you know, it definitely was a black card that, you know, no, I don't know the card.
It matters anyway, but.
So anyway, we took off, we did our show and we took off and, you know, we're going to wake up in Copenhagen and it was a winter. So let's see, when was it? It was actually, wasn't quite the winter. I mean,
it was October, wasn't it?
Nope, September 26th.
September 26th, yeah.
But I mean, you know, you're in Norway, Stockholm, you know, you're in
Spain. It was really fucking cold. Yeah.
So we were driving down the road, uneventful. We all got on the bus, good show, nothing to speak of. Everybody went to bed, and I'd say somewhere, I'm going to call it 2 a.m, 4 a.m. It was actually daylight break. So it would have been later. And it was the winter. So it could have been 6 a.m. Sure, one of us could look and find out. We all woke up to the bus just spinning. Like, it was actually going that way.
Yeah.
And people screaming. Everybody was asleep. No shit flying everywhere. Luggage, clothes, so on. And eventually it turned, the bus turned over on its side, on the driver's side, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe not.
Yeah, the driver's side would have been on the other side, right? Would have been on the right-hand side of the bus, yeah.
Driver's side in those buses. No, they're...
It's an English bus, wasn't it?
An English bus, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it ended up. I remember the wheels were facing off the road.
Yeah,
I guess. No, maybe not. I'd have to look at a picture. Anyway, we walk up to the bus spinning, and as the bus came to a screeching halt and crash and settled, you know, I mean, I started to count people. I had no training in this at all. I mean, you know, I was taking care of everybody. So I started trying to figure out if anybody was hurt or what. And Aiden had fallen into something, had probably still had his blanket from his bunk, I guess. And he was under something, under some part of the bus. And I don't really remember how he got out. All I know is that he was suffocating. And me, maybe somebody else helped me. I'm getting shivers right now. Pulled the blanket out, covering his face. Pulled it right out off him. And, you know, police were there. We popped open the emergency hatch. Some of us started climbing out. And that's when somebody said, "Where's Cliff?" And since the bus... So what had happened is right at that stress point, wherever Cliff's bunk was, of course, there was a window next to it. So right at that stress point, that must have been enough force to push him out of the window. And, you know, they told us that he didn't, probably didn't feel a thing. So... You know, you can believe what you want to believe, but it was, and I don't know, I guess people say that to be comforting. I mean, still, I mean, we all woke up. He had to have been up for a minute, but it was quick. I'd say that.
How did you get out of the bus, Bobby?
Climbed out the emergency hatch with most people. I don't remember how we, Aiden, did they have to come in and pull you out?
So
the bus got stuck in the bus, right?
I can elaborate a little bit. On the entire thing in that
before when you guys got on the bus, were you drinking, playing card games and stuff, or did everybody just crash?
I would imagine that we were having a few beers, as you would do after a show, a successful show.
Plus you're going back to Lars's like homeland.
Going back to Copenhagen. Everybody was excited about that. And
remember, we were in Sweden, so there we wouldn't have really been, we wouldn't have had other things. And
yeah. Yeah. You know,
where was the driver dude? Was the driver dude climbed out of the exit too?
Don't remember.
I can't speak to any of that.
The police took him in.
Yeah.
Oh, they did.
So
was he the same guy from England, or this is a guy you didn't know?
I mean, we didn't know. This was a new band. We didn't know anybody over there.
Yeah. The driver of the bus that we were in Scandinavia, let's just say, because we were, I guess, again, Sweden to Denmark, was an English guy. And I'm drawing a blank on his name and I feel terrible right now. What I can say is that I woke up when the bus initially, Bobby and I have never had this discussion before.
I don't think I've had it with anybody.
No, and I haven't had it with anybody in an official context at all. But I am a light sleeper to begin with. And I woke up when the bus went off the road prior to the spinning. And it was, I don't want to use the word violent necessarily, but it was a, you know, an enthusiastic rumbling and bumping and, you know, that kind of thing that woke me out of a dead sleep. And then there was a pull and then the bus started to spin, but it was like everything just kind of stopped at that point. There was no more rumbling. There was no more tire noise. There was no more engine noise. There was nothing but like just a whoosh kind of a sound as the bus spun on came back. I felt the pull back on the road, and then the whooshing sound of the spinning of the bus, and then the bus hit what I think was an embankment of some kind. It hit something, and there was a bang, and the bus flipped over on its side. And all I remember is things crashing, you know, and piling up on me. I had a fucking Anvil briefcase back then that probably weighed 78 pounds that I carried everywhere with me. And that thing hit me in the head, you know. And then I remember stuff piling on me. And then I realized I couldn't breathe any longer. I couldn't breathe. And I distinctly remember the realization that at that point, that was going to be it. I couldn't catch my breath. I was pinned. There was no one that I could hear or see, or it was all dark. And I basically, I know it probably sounds cliched, but at that point, I realized that I wasn't going to be going home. And when that happened, it was kind of like you hear in the movies, you know, it was kind of like, okay, here's what's happening. And then the next thing I know, stuff is being pulled off of me. And the next face I see is this fella right here. And I could breathe. I couldn't move, but I could breathe. I had pain in my back, pain in my leg, pain in my arm, pain in my head, but I could breathe. And it was Bobby looking in at me. Now, I thought my perspective of it, and it could have just been the circumstances, but my perspective of it was maybe that you were looking back in through the hatch in the roof, or you were hanging in through the hatch. I don't know.
He was in the bus. I remember pulling that blanket off and you being under something and on your back.
Yep. And so the thing of it is, and again, this is something that from an official standpoint and a public standpoint, I've never had this conversation other than, you know, maybe close friends or family. But I was pinned with my arm out to the side, and there was somebody laying on my shoulder. And all I could see was blonde hair. And that was it. And I distinctly remember asking Bobby to get me out. And I can't remember if it was Bobby that made the realization, or if it was me that made the realization, or if it was him telling me that it was Cliff. But I do remember saying to Bobby, if you get me out of here, I'll help Cliff get out. And I remember, Bobby, you telling me not to worry about Cliff. And that's when I realized fully what had happened.
You know, it's interesting that none of us went through any counseling whatsoever.
I did for a while on my own.
Nothing that they directed us to. There was no.
No, there was none of that.
Free counselor. I mean, we were all sent home.
Yeah.
stayed behind to make sure Cliff's body got back to California in Copenhagen, and had to deal with that for a little bit. And I mean, I had a broken collarbone. Lars had a broken foot or something.
Yeah.
They took us all to this hospital, and we were still in Sweden. They took us to this hospital, and I was just reading something about Scott Ian had written an article, because Anthrax did that date with us.
They did.
But they left early because there was a storm and ice.
Yep.
So the guy hit ice.
Yep.
And
it was obvious.
They investigated it. He was considered not at fault, but I mean, remember getting out of the hospital finally, and I don't know, I must have arranged the van for the crew, and then I had a taxi for me and the band. What, there was really no band. And I remember saying something about, no, this taxi's for the band, and I don't know which one of them was, probably James. He said, there's no band. Cliff's not here. There's
I remember you telling me that.
And I mean, no one really knew what was up and what was going to happen with them. And we were all, you got to remember, we were all, things were different in those days. We were close. I don't, you know, I mean, my recent history is working with a lot of artists and, you know, where you're really separated from.
Yeah, this was nothing like that.
There's nothing like it. We all sort of came up together. I mean, I was new. I was almost as new as they were, honestly.
Yeah.
Never been a tour manager before. I don't even think I was 30.
Yeah.
So I was 28.
It was a bunch of kids traveling the world, playing music and having a good time, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember that. Those of us that didn't live there, we came to the funeral, I think we did a memorial service. I don't think we're actually at the funeral. That was probably just a family. And
then we go back to Cliff's folks' house.
Right.
Afterwards, my mom and dad came. My mom and dad came with. That's where you met them, I want to say.
No, I think I'd met your dad before that, but
Ray and Jan's house, and we were all gathered together there.
I got pictures somewhere of it.
Yeah,
and then they had a meeting that day. They had a meeting with Peter Mensch that day, and then Peter had a meeting with me, Eddie Kircher. I think that's it, because by that point Eddie was kind of stage managing, whatever.
Well, you dubbed him production manager on that European run after all this, because we were in France, I want to say, the night that you made that announcement.
Sure, there's a story behind that too, but
yeah. Another day.
So after the accident, though, you guys had a couple weeks, and then you went back to work.
Oh no, it was more than a couple of weeks.
It was shorter than.
It was shorter than anyone expected, I can tell you that. I mean, you know, I don't remember when we did the memorial service, but it couldn't have been more than a month later. And the band decided, you know, like I said, at that memorial service, they had the meeting with Peter that they were going to continue on and look for a bass player. So I I became Eddie Kircher's roommate, or he became mine. We moved into apartments in San Francisco, Lars, James, and me. And they started doing auditions.
Yep.
And so you were there, both of you guys were there during the auditions?
Yep.
Well, I never really made it out to the auditions because I was dealing with all the logistics of getting everybody picked up and who was going where and so on and so forth.
The place where they held the auditions, I don't remember what it was called, but it was very much like a scene out of Hostel. You know, it was a creepy, dingy, dark.
It was their old rehearsal space.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. In Haywood, yes. Where it was almost like a locker.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So was John Cazula there too?
No, John was long out of the picture because John, you know, I mean, John was always around cheering them on, because Metallica got signed before I came along. Elektra bought them out. Michael Lago, who
right,
a whole other story Joel will talk about. We ought to see if we can get Michael on one day, Joel, because his life has certainly changed. But Michael Lago signed them. So they were on Elektra.
Got it. So once Elektra came in the picture, John was out of the picture.
Yeah, he was always around, though. I mean, you know, there was there were I don't know if there was what the continued business was. But, you know, no, it was Q Prime. I mean, Q Prime hired me.
Oh, really?
It was even before they had an office.
What were some of the better and some of the worst auditions you remember I made in?
Well, most of them were pretty awful.
Yeah.
You know, back then it was so.
50 people, I think we had.
Yeah, it was. Wow. Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. It was the dingy, creepy version of a Nashville cattle call, you know, where it was literally like a line of guys.
Yeah.
And one of my jobs was driving a van and shuttling auditionees to and from the airport to the rehearsal room and back. And the one that stands out in my head probably more than any of the others was I drove to San Francisco Airport, and I'm in a, you know, like a Chevy passenger van, you know. I drove to San Francisco Airport to the arrivals area. And I remember driving through, and I'm looking around, and I see this skinny kid with long curly hair and a black leather jacket, and black stretch pants. And I leaned over and rolled down the passenger window, and I shouted over and I said, "Hey, are you Jason Newsted?" And he just looked at me and went like that. And I pretty much knew at that point that he had a pretty good chance.
Well, if you remember when you picked Jason up, he left all his gear at the airport. And I don't even know how anyone called me because, I mean, so I was whatever office or whatever apartment I was in.
Yeah, no cell phones back then.
Phones. So, yeah. So it had to be a pay phone. Yeah. Hey, I got to go back to the airport. I left all my gear there.
Yeah. I don't recall him ever saying anything to me on the drive to the studio about that. But that could just be one of those many things that I've forgotten. But I remember driving him over the bridge and having a chat with him and just thinking, I'd say he stands a pretty good chance of getting this gig, you know?
And they actually do his audition?
Yeah.
He was good.
He was good.
Yeah, they locked it in, I heard. Almost right away.
Yeah. He was the first guy that came in and, you know, you had a bunch of people there auditioning for Metallica because they were auditioning for Metallica.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Jason was a kid, shit, we're the same age now, I guess, or close, who wanted that gig more than anybody on the face of the earth. You know, he knew that he was the right guy for it. And you know, when you get yourself into that headspace where there's no question in your mind, there may still be questions in other people's minds, but in his mind, he was the right guy for the gig. And I think that came out in his audition because it was like guys glancing at each other going, okay, you know, what's going on here? You know?
Did you end up teching for him?
I did not. I was still working for James at the time.
Okay.
And
no, it was Zach.
We Zach Harmon came on board. Yes, indeed. And I remember we did the Cat Club. Do you remember that, Bobby? We did. So with Jason, Jason's first run with Metallica was, I want to say two club gigs.
Troubadour.
The Troubadour and then the Cat Club, or I can't remember. But then we went to Japan.
Right.
So Jason's first official gigs with Metallica were in Japan. And again, my first.
Some shithole in Long Beach.
That's the one I'm trying to remember.
Long Beach and the Troubadour.
Yeah. The Long Beach one is the one I'm drawing a blank on the name. I remember it being truly that, a shithole.
Hopefully it burned down.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's where we met Zach.
Well, we knew Zach from Armored Saint.
Exactly.
You think Jason fit into the fold real quick?
I don't know. I think so. What about you, Bobby? Do you think Jason fit in pretty quick?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I'll say this, you know, I mean, my life's a lot different now. And Joel and I share some of that. And have mellowed in my, I won't say old age, years. Very, become very spiritual. I read and practice in Buddhism, which is new to me. I meditate every day. Awesome. I practice yoga. I don't yell at anybody anymore. I had my share. I was totally own up to that.
Okay.
I have nothing to hide. I own every mistake and every good thing I ever did. They're both mine. But we never processed, Cliff. I don't believe the band to this day. This is the deepest conversation I've had about Cliff ever.
Me too.
And this isn't even deep, because Cliff and I were dear friends. I mean, we were close. I mean, we bonded. We hung out if I was in San Francisco or was at his house. I mean, we ate together. We went out together. It wasn't really that close with the other guys. James in those days was very much to himself, and yeah, you know, was feeling his way. You know, we were kids.
Yeah.
You know, Lars has always been Lars, I guess. And you know, Kirk's still full of wonder and curiosity. But I mean, Cliff and I bonded. Cliff was older by a few years. And Cliff was eons older than them in life.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
And Cliff had a vision for what Cliff was. Cliff had the most wonderful family life that, I mean, he had death in his family because his brother had died, but yeah. Cliff's family were family. And Cliff was very grounded. And Cliff really didn't give a shit what you thought about his fucking bell bottoms or what anybody had to say, but the man was about truth. Yeah. And he was, I don't know that there was a band leader in those days, but I can tell you that if Cliff didn't like it, it wasn't going to fucking happen. Lars and James wrote everything, but Cliff was like Charlie Watts, okay?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you ask anybody that really knows that camp about the Stones, Charlie Watts was the fucking soul of that band. And if Charlie didn't like something, it didn't happen. And that was the same way with Cliff. And we put Cliff to bed. We put him to rest. We honored, you know, his life. We honored his death. But none of us ever talked about it. None of us.
Yeah.
We got going with Jason. And I'm going to get to something in a minute, because I hope that he listens to this for what I'm going to say next. We never processed it. We held it. We bottled it up. We never really, I mean, you know, we could have all fucking died, right? I mean, we could have easily all died, but Cliff died. We never, so we just got on with it. And, you know, it was all good for Jason because, you know, he was probably the happiest kid in the world. But because there was no grief counselor, virtually no time.
Yeah.
I remember maybe... I remember I was raised Jewish, and at that point I hadn't been in a temple in, you know, I was maybe 30. I probably hadn't been in a temple in 15 years. And I remember it was right around the high holidays that I went and prayed for Cliff and for everybody. But that's as deep into it as I got.
Yeah.
And here comes Jason Newsted, high in the sky. Best gig of his life. His life, you know, things happen, you know. I mean, and man, he took such a load of shit. And I mean, none of us had really been on the road. I guess I'd been to Japan. Maybe I'd been to Japan. I don't think many others had.
I never had been.
And, you know, that's a different thing. But, and they were kind of rock stars even then, Japan. They were sold everything out. I mean, it was beginning at that point. And, but Jason, I mean, we pranked him. Yeah. Fucked with them. I mean, endlessly. And honestly, Jason, if you ever listen to this, dude, I apologize. Because if... And I never grieved Cliff either, so I guess I was mad at you too. And it's a weird thing. And but he fucking stood in there, man. I'll tell
he
you what.
He took that shit. He took it.
He stood in there. And I remember being in a bar in Japan with Peter Mensch. Jason wasn't there. Kirk, Lars, and James. And Peter said to him, "He's in your fucking band now. He's not Cliff. He's in your band now, and you need to treat him right." And I think things started to change a little bit then. But, you know, Joel, you know what? I got to say, man, I don't. When you asked, when we talked about this, and was it a taboo subject? Was it something I wouldn't talk about? Mm-hmm. I don't even think I realized how this would make me feel. Like, yeah. I'm happy for it.
Okay, good.
I'm uncovering some stuff that, you know, I hadn't even thought about in many years. And this, by the way, if you can see this.
The skull, okay.
That is Cliff Burton's, that's Cliff Burton's skull ring.
That's his ring, yeah.
That is folks, Ray and Jan, said that this is for you, Bobby. Cliff would want you to have this.
Wow. I thought James wore a ring like that.
He might have. I mean, there might have been more than one.
That's cool, man. That's really cool.
So, you know, I don't know that we ever, I've had a lot of death happen in the past few years.
Yeah.
And I'm very accepting of it. So, and I always have been. I don't know. No one ever taught me that or anything. I just accepted that Cliff was gone, but we never talked about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it aged all of us. It had to age all of us a lot, but we didn't even talk about it to each other.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I agree. It was, yeah.
I don't ever remember saying shit. I miss Cliff.
Yeah. We lived it. You know, we were in the thick of it and things were moving so quickly that we never had the opportunity. We, you know, it happened so fast. You know, Jason came along so fast. We were right back out on the road again, and we had to think about that. And the band was exploding, you know, that we had. When did we have time to?
Well, I wonder who would have been the one to pull the trigger and say that you guys need to do it because you're all young. Who would have made the call?
A parent, a manager, someone that knew better. I don't know.
I'd say Mensch and Bernstein had.
I mean, but listen, you know? things were different, you know. I mean, we were not touchy feely back then, you know, and
yeah,
it was come on, it was metal. I mean, you know, it was leather, yeah. And denim and leather and you know and rock and roll and you know living large. I mean, you know, listen, rock and roll's had a history. A lot of people have died. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, and.
Yeah, but the hard part with Cliff is like none of it was his fault. Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting perspective for sure.
That truly doesn't. You know what? I don't know that it matters. I listened to something a while ago, and I'm sure this is. This may, I don't know if it has a form, but I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about death and they were talking about if there was an afterlife and where do you go?
Yeah.
And the person being interviewed said, well, you don't go anywhere. You're here. You still stay here.
Yeah.
You still maintain this space. And the person doing the podcast was like, well, what do you mean? He said, well, here's a practical analogy. We're in this room in this building. If the building was to go away, and the room was to go away and the building would go away, the space would still be here.
Okay.
So, you know, Cliff is still with us. I don't know. You know, Metallica are a very different animal right now. They are They, you know, when I worked for them, they wouldn't ride in a limo.
No, they'd stay after. Remember them stay. Remember us setting up tables.
Yep.
The
maddest they ever got at me. We played Hammersmith on this tour. We played Hammersmith, and they signed autographs like for hours.
Yeah.
And there was some after party happening. And I mean, there were, you know, and it was cold out, I guess. We were outside.
Yeah.
And I made the band leave. And I mean, you know, I don't make them leave, but whatever, we left. And Lars came up to me later. He said, never do that again. He said, if there's two kids out there, we're signing their stuff.
Yep.
And that's what they were about. Now, I'm not saying that they don't care about their fans now. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying that, you know, chemistry changes. And I really wonder what they would have been huge, I think, still. But I don't know that, you know, I mean, now, I mean, look at the machine they are. You know, they're the biggest band in the world. They travel like, you know, any other rock star royalty, private planes, you know. The best of this, the best of that. I mean, they deliver fantastic shows. They still put out great, you know, great material. That new song is fucking great, by the way.
Cool.
They're planning a cool tour this summer. They do cool things. They give back. So they're good fucking people.
Yeah.
You know that those guys flew many of us to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, all expenses paid. When they got inducted.
Yeah.
I mean, it had been 20 years since I worked for them. And I only worked for them for 5 years, but I was there for a pretty pivotal point.
Yeah.
And they threw a bunch of us back. Aiden, were you there?
Nope.
Sorry, I didn't mean to make it sound like
that's awkward moment.
Yeah, no, I wasn't on the guest list.
Well, we thought about you. and I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying that this is good that we're remembering Cliff. We did something a while back. I mean, they have a Cliff Burton Day in the Bay Area. I've been to a couple of those.
Did you read that his parents give the money to the school that he went to?
Yeah. Well, both his parents are gone now.
Yeah. We lost Ray just recently.
Dan's gone 10 years, maybe longer.
Yep.
And Ray, not so long ago. But they do it every year.
He has a sister still then?
Yep, Connie. I'm Facebook friends with her.
Yeah, I got in touch with her. It's been probably 3 or 4 years now, and was able to communicate with Ray through her, which was really awesome.
Yeah.
I saw him just before. I saw him once or twice. And, you know, I mean, I remember my mother saying to me, she said, you stay in touch with that family, even if no one else does.
Yeah.
Make sure that you stay in. And I did.
Yeah.
Awesome. Did they used to go to the shows?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That's good stuff. What do you think Cliff would have thought of the newer albums, the Black Album, Reloaded, Loaded?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that Cliff would have ever changed from flannel and bell bottoms. I don't know if Cliff would have enjoyed the highlights.
Yeah.
I don't know if Cliff, I think Cliff would have dug playing in stadiums.
Yeah.
I think Cliff would have dug fans.
Yep.
I don't know that Cliff would have dug pyro. I just don't know, you know. I mean, he was a purist. I mean, you know, he was a Bud and Marlboro guy. Actually, he didn't drink Bud, but he was pretty down to earth, and that was his upbringing.
Yeah,
and you know, those guys come from, you know, from very different walks of life. But I don't know, man. You know, listen, I think that he, you know, he probably would have taken to being a rock star. I mean, he was. They, you know, they were, He was definitely a star. If you watched him play on stage, the one thing about Cliff Burton is there was nothing else he could do but play that bass.
Yeah.
He never had a job anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that he came to terms with his brother's death? Were you guys close enough to make any judgment on that, do you think? Or
I couldn't tell you.
We never talked about it. I mean, I vaguely knew about it, and I think I came to know about it more
after,
later on, you know, maybe through conversations with some of the people that are still, you know, around that might have talked about Cliff, or maybe it's something I read. I mean, you know, do you ever really come to terms with it? You know, you have to accept it.
Yeah, I think his brother was 16. I don't think that's something that you come to terms with.
No, I mean, I think that it always leaves. I think the thing to remember is it's always going to leave a hole. I heard this quote the other day, and I hope I'll say it right. And it was that grief or grieving is just love without a place to go. Huh. I thought that was probably the most beautiful thing I ever heard.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Summed everything up that it made, you know. So I don't know. I can tell you Cliff was a very balanced and grounded man.
Yeah.
He did not suffer fools, and there was no bullshit. So if he was traumatically affected by death at that young age, you'd never know it.
Yeah.
I'd say the family missed him, and you know, and maybe part of his brother was a musician too. That's who turned him on to music. So, you know, maybe in his brightest moments, that's who he thought about. I hope so.
I hope so too. Standing in front of those people, your band's taking off. You put the hours in, that's for sure. You know, it's exciting. It's cool. A bit of a fun one here. My buddy, Darren Paltrowitz, he has another podcast and we've become friends. And he said, how come, the question is, why shit on Winger so much? Do you have an answer to that? Or, and the other part he actually did was,
say that again?
Winger, why does Winger get shit on so much? He said, Rat got a pass. You guys had worked with Rat early on. He said that there was a rumor that Bob Rock came on to Metallica's camp because of Dr. Feelgood, and that the guys in the band thought the album sounded so good.
Oh, no, I was gone by then.
Yeah, me too. Me too, unfortunately.
All right. And then the second part. So I got to meet Jason. Jason, I should say, is an artist. I hope he's still doing art. But he did that TV show, the Rockstar Supernova show.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I toured with that.
You did?
But Jason wasn't there.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. He was smart enough to get out.
Kind of a precursor to all of the other TV shows that are on.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's early on, man. It's early on. Yeah, I went to the show and I was going there to talk to him about his art and stuff. And he was awesome. But, yeah, he was so excited to be talking about art. I don't know how much he cared about the TV show, But so why do you guys think he left Metallica?
What do you think, Bobby?
I think he wanted to have a life.
I was there when he left. I had a history with them where I would come and go. And I was back there and we were in LA. We had just done something at the Shriners Theater there. One of the awards things. And, we were on our way to the airport the next morning, very early in a shuttle bus. And Paul Owen, our monitor engineer friend, looked at me and he said, Jason's done. He's leaving. And I said, what do you mean? Because I didn't see it coming. But in fact, that was Jason's last night with the band.
Whoa.
And I guess I don't pay attention to drama as best I can avoid it.
Sure.
It's not good for me. It's not good for anybody. But there was a lot going on there that I obviously missed. So I was taken by surprise when that happened. I really was. I couldn't tell you the ins and outs of it. I couldn't tell you the details because of that. It was a startling revelation. And especially at that point where they were just, you know, they were just going at that point.
I don't think it was what I don't think Jason wanted to be in all the trappings. And I think that I'm not sure they ever really gave him the due and the respect he deserved.
I'd agree with that. I didn't see it, but I would agree with that. Having talked with him.
He's going to be Jason Newkid.
Yeah.
Maybe it didn't come from all of them, but he wasn't Cliff and he had replaced Cliff.
Yep.
And I think he always felt aside and, you know, I didn't know him back in those days. So, I mean, by then I'd long gone. I mean,
yeah.
But that's what I think from knowing Jason and knowing what it must have been like. And I mean, he didn't need the money at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, whether he could have made many millions more or not, obviously he thought, I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
What balls that must have taken.
Oh, no shit. Dude. You imagine walking away from that? Unbelievable.
Crazy.
What balls that must have taken.
Yeah.
Well, it's back to, you know, the way one life to live and live it to its fullest. Maybe you conquered everything. You're in the biggest band in the world, you know?
Yeah. So,
at the height of it.
All right, brother. Love you, man. Love you both.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Take care, guys. Wonderful. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Hey, rest in peace, Cliff Burton.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. Good night, fellas.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed the show. I now have a Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Discord, and even a Patreon. The Patreon you can join for as little as $1. The handle on all of them, it's of course, Joel Rohde. I'll see you guys on the next one.